You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading, and in this hour, we're talking about the homeless in rural America. Up first, we hear from Bill Vino, founder and chairman of Ashland Cares. The nonprofit organization has been serving the homeless in the Ashland area for the last couple years. Recently, the group purchased an old vacant school that will be refurbished and become a homeless shelter. Vino spoke with me by phone yesterday about their search for a shelter and why the shelter is needed in the Ashland area.
Well, we had been looking around town for quite a while, you know, in the area for buildings. And size-wise, some of them didn't make sense. Some of the placings they were in didn't make sense. We ran into a few barriers on the owners of the buildings and things like that. And we started to think, you know, we had driven past the school for years out there and started thinking about it. And we thought, you know, for what it would cost, when we looked at some of the buildings in town, for what it would cost to buy a building outright plus repair what they had, because most of them needed some sort of refitting, you know, it would be quite a bit of money. So when we looked at the school, we checked into the cleaning and to the roofing and things like that. And what we want to do it is in sections. So anyways, when we looked at it, we thought, why not basically bring the people in that society seems to be ready to throw away and put them in the building they're doing the same with? We decided that it seemed like a good fit. And the location was nice because it gets us out of the city. I mean, there's a reason for that. We are on a bus route now, so, and we do have volunteers that drive. So we thought it would just be a more serene place, you know, to restructure your life, to be able to find your place again, I guess is the word I want to use. So anyways, we checked with the owner of the building, and she decided to make a deal with us actually within a couple of days of us inquiring on it. So we just decided to go for it. Because financially for the organization, we were able to do it that way. I mean, in the deal that she offered us, which was, you know, much more feasible than going downtown and say, hey, we want a $300,000 building that's on the market, but we have to raise money for it also first. So, I mean, doing it that way just doesn't make sense. But to get one at a much cheaper price and then refurbish it to match what you need makes a lot more sense.
And how much did you pay for it?
Total price for the building, I think, was like $48,000 minus $9,000 discounted by the seller. She donated in $8,000. And we're doing a small fundraising to go for like a down incentive money. So the total financed amount, I think, is like $33,000. 2 acres with the building and everything. So, I mean, realistically, it's not bad. I mean, some people might say yes or no, but realistically, it's not a bad price for that amount of square footage.
Yeah, because how big is it?
You're asking me a question I don't know today. 80,000 square feet. I mean, it's big. But what our plans are to utilize the building over time, not the whole thing at once. There's a small addition that was made for the grade school years ago, and that is our focus. That's where the shelter area would be, which will be, it's pretty much self-contained. And then the main school building would have a different purpose. We're kind of working on that one yet. And then the gymnasium and lunchroom area will be more of an event center, which could house our own type of presentations or plays, or maybe if somebody needed a place for a wedding reception or a family reunion, school reunion, maybe a wintertime garage sale. And once it's open, it'll always be open for people who want to come in and exercise or walk around and do things free of charge. And the lunchroom, one of our ideas there would be to, once we can get that part refurbished, which won't be right away, would be to have an open community area where daily people could come in. If they just didn't want to spend a time alone having a meal, they could come in and sit with whoever's there and enjoy some company and have lunch or dinner and spend some time with us. I think partially, too, to take away that stigma there is between the homeless and people that aren't homeless, so it kind of helps both sides.
And how many people are you hoping to offer housing once the shelter gets up and running?
That, at this point, is still, we're still working on it. We're still working on the logistics on it. I honestly don't have a number yet. It's going to be, to start with, it's going to be low. I'm going to guess opening up, because our office will be in the building, and we have to take time to refurbish and raise money. So I'm going to guess to start with probably only like 8 to 10 people to start with. But you've got to build up to that. So we're still working with on the paperwork for that. So it's really hard to say. There's so many things we have to go through, and since we're going to start out with the smallest part of the building, I mean, that's why I have to try to be as reserved as I can on the number, because it's going to be a, you know, like I said, also house our office. And that particular end will also have a place for people to eat. It's got to have showers in it and all that kind of fun stuff. So, and it all takes up space. But the fact that we'll be able to get people off the street and have the option and future ability, you know, to change that is what we all need. Because right now in the area, there isn't a shelter in 3 counties. And the one in Superior is usually full. And we have some south of us, but it's costing all the organizations $40 to $60 a day per person to put them in the motel. And we only have one motel in Ashland in the area that will allow us to do that. There is one or two that periodically we can do it, and we have one in Iron River, but it still costs to transport. You know, they still need to be close to some service.
The shelters that you've been trying to send people to are full, so you have to resort to getting them a hotel?
Yeah. Like New Day is a domestic violence organization, so I mean that they're limited in what they can do. And we work with them too, because sometimes that's just the situation. I mean, we work with as many as we can. But yeah, like if we just need shelter space, the first option basically is to put them on a bus and send them to Superior. And there have been some, you know, speculations, and I think that's one of the hardest part. Is people have speculated that we're busing people in, but I mean, we do bus people out. We bus them to locations that are better served for them, even if it's a family member that they can go to that's in another state. I mean, we bus people all over the U.S. basically, but and to other shelters within the state of Wisconsin. So we it's not like we're loading up on people. We're trying to take care of our local people, and if someone does happen to be stranded or wanting to go someplace else, I think all of the organizations provide bus tickets when possible to be able to get those people home.
How far have you had to send people in order to get them housing?
We have sent people to, I think, Fargo, California, and I think Florida. I've sent a few people down to Green Bay, Milwaukee, Chicago. The ones within the state, we usually want to go to Milwaukee or Green Bay. There's some really nice shelters down there that provide a lot of other supportive services, like actually some schooling and or assistance in that area, and better job placement. You know, it's all in one unit.
Well, Bill, I know you've been working on this for a long time to get resources to people in need. What do you think needs to happen in the local community to try and reduce homelessness?
There's a lot of factors that play into homelessness. Unfortunately, one of the biggest misconceptions is our drugs and alcohol. The job base up here is low. It's extremely low. And a lot of the jobs are service jobs. I mean, there's not a lot of labor jobs, or, you know, I don't think we really have any major factory jobs. We do have some companies that employ quite a few people, but there's still not enough jobs, and housing is severely limited. And if you're applying for housing through any of the federal programs, and some of the ones that we administer through a partner agency, I mean, there's limits on income, there's limits on rent, you know, maximum amount for an apartment. So there, you know, there's certain factors that play into it, and people don't realize that each program, even if they're coming from the same office or within a group of offices, they're usually running in the end through the same funding source, which means they still have to fall to those rules. I mean, like if we run somebody through one of the housing programs here, we're going through somebody else's rules. We're just, you know, helping get them going here. And with all those things that are happening, that's why we're basically striving to for the Endoscopy Center to try to offer a place that, I suppose you could call it a clearinghouse, kind of, but it's one of our, I guess our taglines on it is the Endoscopy Center bringing people home, and that's kind of our point. We're giving them a home base to start with so they can reorganize on what is available.
So what are people doing in the meantime, then, as you've been working with them? Where are they going?
The first year we were in operation, we had put people in full operation. We put people camping all over the area, and we had put people through the city. The following year, the city had publicized a camping program that, even though we'd already done it for a year with awesome success, it was publicized, which kind of left the area, I think, on a sour note. So this year, they canceled the program at the last minute. So we're unable to put people in the campground anymore. When we have people out camping or where it may be, we check them 3 to 4 times a day. Volunteers will go through and check things. So as far as problems go, we've never really had any incidences, I think, other than a couple that involved people we were working with directly. You know, you're bound to get into an incident in general throughout any city.
Well, when are you hoping to get people into the Endoscopy Center?
We would, if everything went wonderfully, we would hope to have it open by fall, in part, at least on that section. But, you know, there's a lot of process to go through with fundraising and repairs and working with the townships and the city or the county. It's a process, I mean, but we still hope, are optimistic and hope that we could be open by then, because we would move our office into that building.
So how important do you think this step is for the community?
For the community, I think it's at the top of the list. The homelessness in our area is huge, and the idea that people may think that it's one of those things that they kind of don't want it in their backyard, well, you know, it's in everybody's backyard, and I think that it's up to all of us who have a roof, you know, to help people that are in trouble and that sincerely need the help. I mean, we obviously can't help everybody in their situations that people wouldn't generally qualify or be able to be taken in due to whatever, you know, whatever extenuating circumstance it was. But in general, we have a huge need because we have kids right now on the street. We have elderly on the street. We have, you know, families with very young children on the street or living in cars, people that are disabled, veterans. I mean, it's here. Whether anybody wants to admit it or not or want to deal with it or not, it's here. I mean, it's prevalent all over the country. For this area, especially since there is no shelter, I think there's a huge need for it. And if done properly and professionally, I think it could work really well. And I think Ashton Cares has, I hope, been working well with all of the agencies in the area. And, I mean, whether it's mental health, law enforcement, the hospital, the BRIC, the Lakes, whichever agency it may be, NWCSA, we try to make sure that we all keep in the loop. So we actually do talk quite a bit and exchange information to try to make it as painless and as safe for everybody involved, whether it's the community or the clients or the people that may be donating or visiting, the volunteers, everybody.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me, Bill. Is there anything else you want to add?
I guess mainly that if anybody has any questions about it or if they have concerns, to please call us. If they're wondering, I mean, we're going to have, we're starting to have our periodic meetings again. We have another one on August 17th at 6:30 at our office. But everyone is welcome to ask us questions. If they see us on the property, they're welcome to stop by and visit with us. We're always open to any suggestions or comments that people may have, you know, regarding the situation. And we're always happy to go to schools or groups and present any information that might help them understand better.
Again, that was Bill Vino with Ashland Cares. You can find out more about their nonprofit online at ashlandcares.weebly.com. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from the head of a national nonprofit that's helping communities prevent homelessness in rural areas. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading, and in this hour, we're talking about the homeless in rural America. Up next, we hear from Moises Loza. He's executive director of the Housing Assistance Council. The national nonprofit helps rural nonprofits and communities to provide affordable housing. The council offers funding, technical assistance, and training to groups who are working to prevent homelessness. He spoke with me by phone yesterday about the challenges with homelessness in rural communities.
Well, first of all, I think what frustrates all of us is the dearth of data, trying to get good information about what the homelessness situation is. That's true for homelessness, both urban, suburban, and rural. But in rural, it's even more challenging trying to find exactly what we're dealing with, the scope of the issue, which always is sort of the first step towards figuring out how you address it. But in rural communities, we do have some challenges. One is that the population is obviously more dispersed. Rural areas, depending on how you define rural, comprise 90% or more of the landmass of the United States. And of course, we're talking about, again, depending on how you define rural, anywhere from one-fifth to maybe one-fourth of the population. So putting that number of people into that big of an area makes it very difficult to get an accurate count. The counting smaller subpopulations, of course, is very, very difficult. And then within that dispersion, you also have specific smaller populations, for example, Native Americans. You also have migrant workers who travel around the country, people who generally are suspicious of bean counters, census takers, and things like that. So that becomes the dispersal of the population, the sparsity of the population is all obviously a big problem in counting that rural homeless population. The other thing is that because of this dispersal, there are no central locations, if you will, for homeless people. In an urban area, there are usually neighborhoods where they congregate, or you get a general idea of some parts of town where homeless people tend to gather. You have food pantries, for example. You have several parks where you know homeless people will spend the night. And you have homeless shelters. So all those are places that you know you can get a congregation or a sampling or an idea, or in fact, you can see homeless people. Whereas in rural areas, you don't have that centralized, identifiable location. So where are they? And I think a lot of times rural homeless people are out of sight. And the fact that they're out of sight means if I want to know where they are or who they are, how do I find them, or where are they? I mentioned earlier the limited contact with service providers. Again, not knowing where to go to find out who they are and where they are makes it difficult to make that connection for people who either want to provide services or want to figure out who they are and do any kind of count. And then the other thing is that we also like to refer to the at-risk or the near homeless, I guess would be a way to describe them. In rural areas, unlike urban areas, because there's a lack of shelters, what we find a lot of times is that people double up. People maybe sleep on someone's couch. And so those people have a roof over their head, so in some ways may not be considered homeless, But at least from our perspective, those people are doubling up not because they want to, but because they don't have any other choice or other home. So it, I think all those things make the rural situation a little different.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up, you know, the fact that rural areas don't tend to have homeless shelters, or at least are lacking them. What other resources are available in rural areas oftentimes?
Well, there aren't a lot. There aren't a lot. The homeless people many times look to neighbors for help, whether it's shelter or otherwise. We know that a lot of the rural homeless go into the woods, maybe pitch a tent or just find a comfortable place in the woods to sleep. We've seen families who sleep in cars because they don't have a home. So I think they become creative and innovative about where they're going to spend the night, all of which are partly because the lack of shelters. Obviously, even where there are shelters, there's a suspicion about or a reluctance to go to shelters. But in fact, we have that problem compounded because we have the lack of shelters in many, many rural areas. If there are centers like food pantries, other places for them to congregate, transportation, the problem of transporting themselves compounds the problem.
Right, because there might be something available to them, but they have no means of getting there.
Exactly.
Okay. I guess you were talking about how it's difficult to get a count of people who are homeless in rural areas because they're so much more dispersed. But given that, I mean, do you get a sense that homelessness, like we see more homeless people in rural areas as opposed to urban areas, or is it kind of hard to judge that?
Well, it's hard to judge. It is hard to judge. HUD does an annual count at one point in time each year. And the numbers that we're able to gather from that, and again, those numbers are, you know, not to be relied upon very, very much. Nonetheless, those numbers tell us that maybe 14-15% that this census identifies are rural. Now, again, there's many definitions of rural, so that also plays into these counts. But disregarding how you define rural, I think we're talking about maybe between 76,000-80,000 rural people in rural America. And again, that's a very bad guess. But that constitutes maybe 14-15% of the homeless population. And again, that would take into account that we're all convinced that there is an undercount in rural America.
So, you know, I'm also thinking about the factors that lead to homelessness, whether it's urban or rural areas. But what are some of the factors that are unique to rural areas that lead people to become homeless?
Well, the economy has a lot to do with it. People fall into bad times. People lose their jobs. They're not able to either keep their payments up where they live, or they're not able to afford housing. As the economy worsens, housing affordability becomes a problem. That's a problem both in urban and rural areas. But that clearly, just the lack of housing is an issue. We have a growing problem, what's referred to as the opioid crisis in rural America. And the scourge of drugs and addiction feeds into despair and people's sort of getting put in situations where they're not able to not just afford housing, but take care of many needs because of the addiction. And we don't know how much of that contributes to the homeless problem, but clearly that is a factor. But affordable, decent housing, access to it, are clearly big factors. There are some things like mental illness, for example, veterans coming back have their own unique problems. But generally speaking, I think overall we're talking about a lack of decent affordable housing for many people, and that, in our view, is a major reason for homelessness.
Why do you think it's so hard to get affordable housing?
Well, we had a recession that cut back on a lot of development. There is development going on, but it tends to be on the higher end of the scale. So that affordable lower-income housing is not making the spring back that housing in general is. It's always been difficult to build in rural areas, again, because of the sparsity of the population. For developers to develop housing, they've got to have some mass. They've got to have some scale to make it worth their while. The rural population, because it's scattered or not as concentrated, does not make development, does not give you the same return on the investment when you're dealing in rural areas. Rural areas also have the lack of institutions, whether it's housing authorities, whether it's centers that provide services for the needy. Those are lacking in many rural areas, and it's difficult to get that kind of movement to advocate and push for affordable housing. So the lack of scale, the fact that it doesn't give developers the return to develop affordable housing, the recovery from the recession, and rural areas tend to lag behind the rest of the country in recovery, all contribute, I think, to this problem.
But, you know, one of the things I think about, too, though, is that there are subsidies that are offered by the government to provide affordable housing. Developers aren't taking advantage of that, or there just aren't as many as there used to be?
Well, I believe, if I remember correctly, one in five eligible people in this country receive housing assistance. So most of the people, most of the families in the country who are in need of housing assistance do not receive it. So that leaves a big swath of the population that is not getting those subsidies. Even if subsidies were available, you need to have a housing stock for families to use that subsidy. I think the lack of development doesn't help. Even if you did have a subsidy, you've got to find the place where the housing is, and in many rural areas, it's not.
Okay, but there are no government incentives, or are there a few government incentives for developers to provide this kind of housing?
There are development incentives. There's a low-income housing tax credit, which gives investors in affordable housing tax breaks, tax credits for the development of housing. It gets back again to the return on investment. As an investor, I'm going to look for the best return, and the best return comes from building a 200-unit development as opposed to a 10-12-unit development. There are programs in the Department of Agriculture to help people in need of affordable housing in rural areas. Those resources are very, very limited. There are resources for home ownership, but that does require credit scores. It requires some stable income revenue to the family, which makes it difficult in rural communities. A lot of rural families fail the credit test. There is no program in rural areas now to build housing for rental, which is one way where many people move on to home ownership. You get a rental unit, stabilize, maybe save some money for a down payment and move on. But it's the dearth of that assistance that has been going down over the last decade or two. That makes the problem more and more difficult.
So what can be done then to address the challenges that we're seeing with homelessness in rural areas?
Well, what is being done sort of on a case-by-case basis is some local communities, I think, are taking it upon themselves to, first of all, get a better sense of the count. We know that the census, that the surveys, the counts that are done nationally don't work as well as they should. And we find that local communities are saying, well, we're going to do the count ourselves because we're going to have a better chance of getting what's accurate, which is always the first phase. First, you've got to find out what you're, what you've got to work with. And then once you've got a good idea, I think then you begin to scrape for resources, whether it's from the local government, the county, the municipality, the state, and also seek federal funding. Now, the federal government has the McKinney-Vento Act, which is a way of organizing every state into continuum of care service providers. And what they're supposed to be doing is taking all the resources available to service homeless people and sort of combining them so they're not all done separately and in silos, but it's done in a more comprehensive way. Those are efforts to sort of address this problem. The efforts are on the local level, not comprehensive. They're happening in some places and not in others. And the attempts to coordinate with a continuum of care approach, dividing the state into service areas, I think is an attempt to coordinate services so you make the most of a limited box. But even with all of that, we still do not have enough resources to address this problem. First, to find out exactly what we've got to deal with, which is important. It's not the most important thing, but it's important to start there. And secondly, to provide the kinds of services and to provide the housing that these families need. The resources just are lacking.
Well, are there any success stories that you've heard of in rural areas where communities have kind of taken it upon themselves to address homelessness?
Well, some localities. I don't want to mention cities because I'm afraid I'm going to mess that up. But I believe Seattle and some other local communities are taking on the responsibility and setting their own goals and targets on addressing that and setting up resources. In rural areas, it's less likely. We have a magazine called Rural Voices, and each issue of the magazine deals with a separate rural issue, whether it's poverty, whether it's Native Americans, whether it's Appalachia. And last year, we had an issue on homelessness, rural homelessness. And in the issue, we try to highlight what a number of rural communities are doing to address the homelessness problem. So where there are successes, I think, is where the locality takes some responsibility and takes some initiative and uses whatever resources, including federal and including state and including local, to make things happen. The attempts by the federal government are very, very helpful. But because they're from a higher level, getting to the specific communities and families, they require the participation of those local communities. And that local effort can make a difference in local communities. Now, I don't want to say nothing is being done. There are many things being done, but clearly not enough. In the last number of years, there was a commitment from the federal government to reduce the number of veteran homeless. And they seem to have made substantive progress. The number of veteran homeless, by all counts, is going down. And so from that perspective, if there's a concerted, targeted, long-term effort, a difference can be made, as was proven with the initiative to reduce the number of homeless veterans.
Well, do you have any advice, I guess, or tips for communities who may be struggling with homelessness in rural areas and what they could do?
I think there are websites. There's a National Association to End Homelessness. Our website, I hope, www.ruralhome.org, have resources or examples. And I think one thing that might be useful is if a local community feels that it really needs to take some action on this issue, is to begin to understand, are there communities that are doing something, and what can we learn from them? What we try to do is provide contacts so that they may not work in their community, but it's a way to begin to educate themselves of what others have tried and others have done. And that begins to give the local community an idea of what they might try and what they might be able to do. And every community obviously is going to be different. So that's why it's good to see what others are doing as examples for ideas. We know, for example, that in the Midwest, we're seeing a loss of population. We're seeing a loss of many manufacturing and other kinds of jobs. So the need there is going to be different, let's say, from the Northwest, where we also know that the homeless population tends to be an agriculture community that goes into areas to pick fruit and do that sort of work. And many times while they're doing that, they have no place to stay, so they end up sleeping under the trees or in their cars. So that's a different situation. So that's why local community involvement becomes important, because even though we count the whole and we look at the whole of the nation, every community has just a slightly different situation that requires its own approach. And I think communities that are doing things can teach those that want to do things, or at least begin to give them ideas about how they can act.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about this issue. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
Well, in rural areas, as I say, because the rural homeless are not as visible, I think a lot of times our community forgets or does not realize that there are people in that situation in their areas. Where they are and who they are is difficult to find out, but they should be aware of that. And being aware of that, I hope, impels them to begin to think, what can we do, and how do we as a community, whether through local government or whether through a local church or through some sort of social service agency, what are resources that are available, and what are resources we can seek, and how can we connect those resources, and how can we seek more resources for those people? But first of all, remember they're there. Recognize that they have needs. Recognize that they're not necessarily people who don't want to have a home. It's people who have fallen into hard times most of the time. We know, for example, that in rural areas, there are more families that are homeless than in urban areas. And we know parents don't like for their children to live in those situations. So recognizing it, understanding that it's there, and beginning to think, how can we as a community make a difference in their lives, maybe give them that chance they're looking for, so they can get out of the situation. And I think everybody benefits when that happens.
Well, thanks again, Moises. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about this.
Well, you're very welcome, Danielle. Thanks for asking.
Again, that was Moises Loza, Executive Director of the Housing Assistance Council. You can find out more about the national nonprofit and the work they do online at ruralhome.org. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear a story about one woman's struggle to find housing in Barron County and talk with the head of a state nonprofit that's working to prevent homelessness in Wisconsin. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading, and in this hour, we're talking about the homeless in rural America. Cities like Madison are in the midst of a housing crunch. There are a lot of people talking about solutions, but most with the goal of fixing what's often thought of as an urban problem. So what's happening outside of the state's cities? Rachel Vasquez takes us to rural Wisconsin to find out.
Heidi Tibbetts is showing me around a place called Benjamin House. She's got bright red hair, and I know she just got off work because she's still in her scrubs. For Tibbetts, home is Benjamin House. It's a homeless shelter in Barron County, a small place with about 45,000 residents in northwest Wisconsin. We go through a shared kitchen and a TV room, and then we get to the two rooms Tibbetts and her three kids have been living out of for more than a month. There's a twin-size bed on one wall and a bunk bed 2 feet away. Clothes and stuffed animals are everywhere. It's a pretty tight squeeze.
I mean, this is like all I've done since I've been here is all these places.
She pulls out a stack of papers. They're all apartment listings.
I probably called 50 places in this last week, and every realty that is around here, from here to Barron, to Cameron, to Shatek, and nothing.
She can't find a place to live that fits her family and her price range. For her, that means nothing above $650 a month.
Pretty much been homeless now 2.5 years, and me and my fiance and our kids have tried for the last over a year now, trying to find a place, and we just keep getting denied.
One of the reasons is her record. She's got an OWI, and her home was foreclosed on in 2012. And when landlords have a lot of applicants, that's one of the first things they look for. Tibbetts isn't shy about her record, though. She's frustrated that people can't see past it.
It's like, are you perfect? Because I don't think one person on planet is perfect. And I think everybody deserves a second chance.
It's not just Tibbetts. There's been a waitlist to stay at Benjamin House since at least 2015.
Right now, we're actually over full, but we get probably 20 to 30 calls a month of people looking for housing.
That's Lori Bowman, the executive director of Benjamin House. The shelter limits people's stay to 90 days just to meet the need.
It's a huge stress, but we have so many people waiting. There's only so much time that we can allow people to, and with our limited amount of space, that's what we can do.
Will Gale heads the group Wisconsin Rural Housing. It's a statewide nonprofit that gives direct housing assistance to the poor. He says housing in Barron County is more expensive than you would expect for a place of its size. And now it's approaching a crisis level.
You see places starting to pop up for rent for $750, $800, even some houses that are getting close to $1,000.
So why is it so expensive to rent in Barron County? One of the reasons is that there's not a lot of available housing. That gives landlords more freedom to raise rents. But Gale says the other factor is income. In a place where 44% of renting households make less than $25,000 a year,
there's a gap in the kind of middle wages that you would expect to see people earning to afford typical 2-3-bedroom apartments. So there's just less people in that middle ground who could afford a place.
And when that group of middle-income renters disappears, that sets up a choice for landlords and developers. They can either target low-income renters or people with high incomes. Nancy Keeler has been a landlord in Barron County for 17 years. Her units top out at $625 a month for a 2-bedroom, so they get a lot of attention.
I will get 40 to 50 calls a week when I have an opening.
And that means many of them are going to get a no.
I have to deny a whole lot of people, because if I have 40 calls in one opening, I can only accept one.
Heidi Tibbetts finally got her yes. The day after we spoke, she found a 3-bedroom house in Hagen. She's happy to have her family in a place of their own, but now she's got new stresses. The new house is infested with fleas. The family's car has started acting up, which could be another big cost. And now she has to cover bills and rent every month. Rachel Vasquez, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Rural Housing serves 69 out of 72 counties in Wisconsin. The nonprofit organization works on preventing homelessness and helping people find affordable housing. They also do home repairs for the state's aging population and community development programs. Will Gale is executive director of the organization, and he spoke with me by phone yesterday about the challenges with housing in rural areas of the state.
So one of the main challenges is the lack of available housing. So whether the inventory is just occupied in areas or that there's just not enough housing to meet demand, depending on the situation, if there is a lot of variation across the state. So for people who are either in between places, are being forced to move, or are currently experiencing homelessness, that is a really big challenge in being able to find a place to even apply to move into, let alone get that application approved and be able to move in a timely manner.
Okay. And so why do you think that is? I mean, what are some of the factors that lead to this lack of housing in rural areas?
I mean, there's kind of two sides to it. One is the more direct lack of housing. So just in some areas, there just aren't enough units. And that's partially because of kind of either just population demographics, where people live is not exactly always where the jobs are, or things like that. So that can be something from time to time. Alternatively, there's also just a problem with income, and that a lot of people we work with do not have sufficient income to afford the housing that is available.
So, you know, it kind of goes hand in hand with like the economic status of the area, or do you see it more as like developers just aren't building affordable housing in rural areas?
So it does. I would say it's a little bit of both. There's some where, because of the scale of developing housing in a smaller community, it's just not as great. So if you don't, if you can only build a fourplex, there's going to be more demand from a lot of developers to build a larger unit in a slightly larger town. So that can be an issue. But then there's also kind of related issue of just there's certain areas in the state that have not recovered to pre-recession levels of income and quality of life. So those places are kind of facing in some cases, a doubly difficult challenge, where they're looking at what is going to be the economic driving factors and how are we going to house people who are either participating in those industries or not in those industries, but affected by the economic challenges in the area.
So how is this affecting these rural communities? I mean, are you seeing more of an exodus towards the cities then? Or, do you think we'll be able to meet the challenges with housing in rural areas?
So there are some people who are moving towards cities or areas of slightly larger economic opportunity. And sometimes that's not necessarily rural area to city. It can be rural area to other town or similar size community in the region. So that we do see a lot, people applying to us directly that they can't find work where they live, but they've been offered a job maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours away. So they're looking to relocate for that reason. So that's definitely something that's going on. But there's also, I would say, many, many more people who don't have the economic mobility to make that move. So that's a question that's kind of larger in my mind, is how are we going to meet those housing needs for people who, whether they're on fixed Social Security incomes or just work low-wage jobs, they just don't have the economic power to make a move to a bigger place. So as a communities across the state are looking at those issues, that's a different challenge as far as it comes to providing housing for people.
So what can those people do then? I mean, if they don't have the means to be able to move somewhere else, you know, what are some of them doing, or what kind of stories are you hearing?
Sure. So people will take a lot of steps to meet their housing needs. A lot of talked about in some areas about the money that's spent on affordable housing, whether it's through Section 8 vouchers or developing housing. And those are big investments that have been made in communities, but unfortunately they're not enough to meet the needs of low-income renters, or in some cases homeowners, but our work is kind of more focused on renters these days. And that's become more and more obvious as the share of people who are spending a greater and greater proportion of their income on housing every month or every year has continued to increase in Wisconsin. So people are having to make difficult choices to kind of maintain their housing. So that in some cases that means spending more than half of their income on housing every month. And that's just not a sustainable situation in the long term. We see every day, multiple times a day, generally speaking, people who are kind of either make about $1,000 to $1,500 a month and spend somewhere between $500 to $700 or more on housing, But when you have a vehicle breakdown and you need to get to work, or your kid is sick and you miss a couple of days, there's just no room for error. And that's when issues of eviction, needing to move out, find places, and then ending up doubled up with family or friends, or for many people, it ends up sleeping on the streets or in camper vans or other places that just aren't safe and habitable for them long term. So that housing affordability issue is a really big piece to community stability. And as that challenge grows, that's something that we see as a bigger and bigger problem for people calling us on a daily basis.
So do you see it as more of a problem with, like, decreasing wages in rural areas, or the rising costs of housing, or both?
I mean, in some areas, there's both going on. Generally, from our look at the numbers and experience across the state, it's been the rising housing costs and the wages not keeping pace with those that's been the bigger issue. So even in some areas where unemployment is relatively low, that housing, if it continues to outpace what people are making for kind of a typical 2 or 3 bedroom apartment for a family, that's going to become a bigger and bigger proportion of the community who's experiencing those problems. Right now, for most areas in the state, that's already about a third to 40% of renters are cost burdened. So they're spending more than 30% of their income on housing every month. And that's kind of the target that we and other places look for to determine what would be affordable in the long term, allowing people to make some gains towards savings, having a little bit of an emergency fund, and be able to meet their other basic needs.
So what's driving that? I mean, why are we seeing these housing costs continue to rise? I mean, is it just because we've seen things come out of the recession and now building is happening again, or is it something else?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, that's a driving factor in there for sure. Just as we've come out of the recession, there's been some more positive economic indicators. In some areas, there's been kind of significant economic growth. So that would maybe lead one to believe that more of the population can afford a higher rent. But for most people, that's not the case. So that's been kind of a driving factor. And then the other is just kind of a supply and demand issue. In some areas, there just is not the enough housing stock or enough decent housing stock to meet the needs of the population. So landlords who do own units, they can raise the rents so that kind of adjust for that, and that can be a real issue for communities.
Well, and how much of this is on the renters or the landlords? You know, I'm just thinking of landlords, you know, I'm sure that they would argue that property taxes are an issue. And I know that Governor Walker has put levy limits or restrictions on cities from raising them. But, you know, what do you see as kind of the issue there, I guess?
Sure. I mean, it is definitely a two-sided issue. Landlords have costs of their own to maintain, and in some cases, they are either investing in properties, so they need to be able to make a certain amount off of these properties to maintain their other incomes. And we work with a lot of small landlords who, if a renter is not paying their rent, they're at risk of losing their own home because they can't pay their mortgage. So it's a very difficult and kind of closely tied relationship when you look at tenants and landlords. So For my opinion, it goes both ways as to who kind of who's at kind of risk with these issues. Because if people aren't going to be able to make their rent payments, and if they do end up getting evicted, that's an expensive process for landlords to go through, as well as tenants, with all of the different court costs, fees, the time that you're not being able to collect rent. So, there's definitely a strong case from the landlord point of view that there's real difficulties and risk in renting, but as a community and as individual communities across the state, we're talking about the provision of housing and a basic need for people. So how do we kind of balance those two things where it's an investment and an income on one side, and it's a basic need for the person who's living there, and if the economics aren't really making sense for both sides, that's something that's going to be a challenge going forward.
Well, and does regulation play a role in that at all? I mean, because I think of things like rental licensing ordinances that have been proposed in some communities. And, you know, does the cost of added oversight of landlords and rentals end up trickling down to renters?
It can in some situations. For the most part across Wisconsin, we aren't a very highly regulated state as it comes to providing housing as a private landlord. There are some communities that have looked at more specific regulations or different licensing, building permitting, other costs. So those things do get passed on to renters essentially. But in a lot of cases, communities don't have a lot of tools to enforce maintenance or upkeep for landlords. So the flip side of that, if there's not sufficient regulation to ensure that the units are safe and well kept and you're getting a fair housing for the price, that really ends up impacting generally the lowest income people first, because those are the units that are generally the first to kind of maybe go towards the neglected side of things or get kind of approaching that substandard housing limit.
And you also kind of see this issue for landlords too, like where maybe they've been affected by the economy and they'd like to be able to rehab or renovate homes, but the cost of doing so is so much that they can't get them ready or habitable for people to rent out?
Yeah, I mean, that's an issue, and it also takes time to rehab a house. So you have to be in an economic position where if you need to make improvements to keep pace with the quality of the other houses, you likely can't rent that out for a period of time. So, there's definitely some economic variables there that go into that. Some of it, though, is also just basic housing maintenance issues that we hear a lot about from tenants. And again, that's a two-way street because we hear a lot from landlords when people leave places in bad shape. But as a tenant, you in the state of Wisconsin don't have a ton of ability or rights to demand maintenance be done to your apartment. So we often hear of disputes that end up really kind of dragging on longer than they need to, or impact both the tenant and the landlord when that sort of regular upkeep and maintenance is not there.
Well, what do you see as some of, if you had a silver bullet or a crystal ball, what do you see as some of the solutions that might be available to communities who are struggling with housing in rural areas?
So if someone does have a crystal ball on this issue, I'd definitely love to hear it. I think some of the things that have been kind of proven to be more successful over other interventions, the Section 8 vouchers, and they are kind of a significant ongoing investment where someone is assisted in paying their rent every month. That's one of the best tools to promote stability for a family, to promote stability for a landlord, because they're guaranteed payment every month of up to the rent that's charged. So it's kind of a tool that works both ways to help lower income renters kind of maintain that stability, but there's a limit to how many units we can subsidize. And in some cases, there's talks of either reducing the number or keeping that funding flat at the federal level, and that will impact Wisconsin families, as there will be fewer vouchers to give out. There will be less people receiving that assistance who really are struggling to meet their housing costs, and where do they go next is kind of a question that a lot of people, I think, are starting to ask. So that will be kind of an interesting development, but vouchers still remain one of the most effective tools. And then the other kind of thing that from what we're seeing is that communities that look at housing as a piece of community development and stability, so as a piece of their workforce development and how they attract new people to the area, housing's kind of right in that mix with everything else. So places that are doing more integrated community planning involving things like new business development and where the housing's located or the housing quality. So places that see improvements in kind of either it could be rentals or home owner occupied situations. Often then the overall quality of the housing rises as those new or improved housing units are made available. So, and there's a kind of separate cost issue that comes with that. But the hope is that over time, as there's a community-wide directed effort towards that, that people will, all people of different incomes and abilities to access housing will benefit from that.
And do you see any communities in rural areas that are struggling with these challenges and maybe having success with new and creative ways to address it?
Sure. I mean, so there's lots of communities across the state. Unfortunately, this is becoming more and more of the reality for small to mid-sized towns in Wisconsin struggling with either having enough housing or having enough affordable housing for the population to live in. But there are definitely places that are seeing success. It's kind of based on community level efforts, but there have been some successful nonprofit housing developers that have been able to go in and really make an impact at a few units at a time in smaller towns and looking things at kind of like a countywide level. Because a lot of smaller towns across counties share a lot of resources. People commute to and from for jobs. So efforts that look at more of regional development have been successful as well in certain parts of the state.
Do you feel like it's kind of heading in this direction where communities are going to have to be the ones to get creative because there's just no incentive there for developers otherwise to kind of provide housing that's affordable to communities?
I mean, I think to be successful and to meet these needs, it's going to take community-level efforts. I don't think that across the board there's no incentive for developers. It just has to be kind of brought about in maybe a different way because some of the larger economic kind of opportunities may not be there for smaller towns. But if you're looking at attracting a developer to an area, there's a lot of kind of really strong resources in parts of the state that it just looks a little different in rural areas. So it takes a lot of times the burden is more on a community or a group of leaders in a community to bring about that development.
Well, is there anything else about the challenges or the struggles with rural housing that I'm missing that you would like to add?
I think we've kind of touched on a kind of wide variety of things. One challenge in particular, and this is just always going to be a thing that rural areas have to contend with, is that when people do lose their housing, and that's ultimately what we're trying to prevent, either through short-term rent assistance or mediation or homelessness prevention activities, there really just aren't a lot of options of where someone's going to go next. So we can talk about it as kind of trends and issues as how our community is going to meet these needs. But when the needs aren't met for individuals, they have very significant consequences and they happen quickly for families in rural and urban areas alike. But the kind of density and how spread out areas are in Wisconsin, you can be miles and miles from a homeless shelter. You can be in areas that have no kind of emergency housing and end up in very difficult situations very quickly.
I mean, would you make any recommendations as to resources for communities who may be struggling with this?
A lot of the local community action agencies across the state are kind of great resources for housing development, if that's kind of the area that the community is specifically looking at. Through our organization, Rural Housing, we do have funds that directly assist low-income families and individuals who are struggling to either find or maintain their housing. So if there aren't the local resources to meet those needs, I encourage either individuals or community leaders who are concerned about this to get in contact with us directly as well.
Again, that was Will Gale, Executive Director of Rural Housing. You can find out more about the organization and the work they do online at wisconsinruralhousing.org. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior, or you can find us on iTunes under Hear Me Out. I'm Danielle Kading, and this has been Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.